shot. That's so fun.
Hey, welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. My name is Teenie.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite things in the world.
Alcoholic beverages. On today's episode, we are going to get into some nitty gritty science.
Yeah, we are. And I'm so excited for today's episode. I love fermented things. They're seriously some of my favorite things. Wine, kombucha, kimchi. I'm like really into it.
These are a few of my favorite things. Well, you know, I like fermented things also, but I'm a big fan of things that are brewed. Also, you know, beer for one. Shocking.
Yeah.
Coffee.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, to get right into it, today we're going to be discussing the main differences between fermenting and brewing.
Yeah, two very important words, but two very different scientific processes.
Absolutely. But before we get started, let's discuss which brewed and fermented beverages we'll be enjoying today. Teenie, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, today, this is really exciting because for this episode, I actually brought a beer that I brewed.
Yay. So cool.
Okay, so this beer, it is called Cat in the Attic, which I can tell you guys that story in a minute. But, yeah. But my friend and I brewed this beer. It is a porter based on a recipe by McKellar Brewing. So we used predominantly pale malts, but we also had some chocolate malts, some crystal malts for caramel flavor, some smoked malts, and some roasted barley. And I mention this all because when we were brewing it, it smelled good. All these like chocolate, roasted, as it roasts. Espresso.
Oh, I love that.
Maillard?
Yeah,
we'll get there.
It's one of those words I can never remember, but I love what it is.
Gosh, it smelled so good. And then we bottled it. And what was interesting about this beer is to carbonate it, my friend had these little drops. So after we put them in the bottle, they were like little sugar pills that he dropped in each bottle.
Lemon drops.
Yeah. So this beer, if for those of you at home, it is like black in color. And it's got like a really small head. We had a little bit of carbonation issues when I tried this beer the other day. So, you know, it's beer. It's all a big experiment.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I was actually got to be there when I was you guys were bottling it.
Yeah. So it looks kind of like liquid oil.
Yeah, what do you think, Ben? Take a sip on over there.
It is got a really nice body. I wish there were more bubbles in it, but it's got this really chocolatey, luxurious taste in the mouth.
Oh man.
And the reason it's called Cat in the Attic is because Thank you. I mean, it's drinkable.
It's beer. You did the thing.
Yeah. And it's called Cat in the Attic because my friend, we were at his house, his roommate had a cat. But while I was there, I was like, oh, I love cats. I want to meet your cat. And he's like, well, she's in the attic. And I was like, what do you mean she's in the attic? She's like, oh, yeah, she ran up there like 12 weeks ago and we haven't been able to get her back down. But when I went over to bottle the beer, he said that they finally got her out. They like opened the door and set up a camera and waited for her to walk out of the door to the attic and then slam the attic door shut.
Oh, that's so funny. Wow. Didn't in some of their exploits to try to get her out of there, didn't his roommate fall through the ceiling?
Yes, he did. Yeah. That was a previous time she was in the attic. He literally
stepped in the wrong place. Living your most shenanigan filled life.
Yeah, you want to smell that?
I do want to smell
it's
that.
It's so yummy in smell and aroma and taste.
Oh, it smells like the perfect winter beer. So good.
All right, Laura, what about you? What you drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, today I have for you. I didn't bring a wine today because we're talking about fermentation. I brought something else fermented.
Okay.
I brought Argus Fermentables Apple Balm from a cidery in Austin. So this specific most actually from Argus, most of their stuff is pretty dry. But so this one is referred to as a demi sec, which is also a medium dry or slightly sweet cider. It's full bodied, has a little bit of tannic and a pucker with it. And the website describes it as an apple explosion.
Apple explosion.
Yeah, it is. So this cidery is just shy of 10 years old, and it's pretty much one of my absolute favorite cideries.
Where is it based out of?
In Austin.
Awesome.
Yeah. So cider tends to be usually a touch sweet for my liking. And to be perfectly honest, it's so sweet, I can't usually like, catch a buzz off of it before I catch a bellyache.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And there's a lot of cider drinkers in Australia, too, which I found to be quite interesting. And there are a lot of great Texas cideries, specifically like Austin East Cider and Bishop in Dallas. But Argus does a few things differently that I really love.
Okay.
The first thing that they use is all Texas apples.
Oh, that is unique.
Yeah. So, and then they also mature their ciders 1 to 2 years instead of shipping them out fresh. And lastly is that they never pasteurize or add any sugar to the final product. So as you can taste, it's pretty tart, mm-hmm. and which is, I like tart bitter drinks. I don't like sweet drinks. Mm-hmm. So same. Perfect. So the result is this unapologetically dry, tart, complex cider. And their cherry one is really great, too.
Excellent.
And not to go on too long about the drinks, but I also have a second fermentable beverage here as well. It is kombucha, and it is from Holy Kombucha, which is based out of Dallas. It's actually ran by a girl I went to high school with. And they...
That's amazing.
10% of their proceeds go to help fight sex trafficking. So they're
awesome.
A really great company. If you have Holy Kombucha available in your grocery stores, definitely grab it.
Yeah, and I know it's available on Draft some places,
yeah,
too, which
Draft,
is really cool.
And it's in Whole Foods. I mean, they're killing it over there, and they're doing a really good job.
Great.
So, yeah. Let's get right into it.
All right, let's get into it. So the reason that this concept between, like, comparing brewing to fermenting first came about is because I wrote a story about a couple of new cideries popping up in town. And
love that story.
Yeah, it was a good one. Shout out to Trinity Cider and Locust Cider. Welcome to the scene.
Yeah.
But when I sent my story to my copy editor, she's an amazing woman, and she rightfully pointed out, you know, I had a line in there that's saying, oh, the head cider maker, he started home brewing cider 11 years ago or whatever. And she looked at me and she said, is that right? And I was like, well, yeah, that's what people say. And she was like, but is cider brewed? And I sat there for a minute.
She's so smart. I love her.
Yeah, I sat there and I was like, no, it's not. So she sort of opened my eyes to that. People use the word brew interchangeably with no matter what you're making alcoholically at home. And then also people use the word brew to describe a beer, like a noun. So just want to like sort of break down those two things, tell you how they're related, although they're not the same thing. So.
Right. Yeah, it makes absolute sense.
Yeah, I guess I'll start by defining brewing. So according to dictionary.com, brewing primarily is to make a beer by steeping, boiling, and fermenting malt and hops. But in general, you can also brew other things. It's to make or prepare a beverage such as tea by mixing, steeping, soaking, or boiling a solid in water. So at its foundational point, that's what we talk about when we're brewing.
That's a lot of great beverages made that way. A lot of great things. Well, I will start by defining fermenting then, fermentation. And we've talked about it surface level before in our... I think in our whiskey episode. So fermenting technically means it is the chemical breakdown of a substance, usually sugar in our case with alcohol, and it's broken down by a yeast, bacteria, or microorganism that then creates a byproduct, usually alcohol in our case.
Yeah.
But the byproducts could be other things like effervescence, which is like carbon dioxide, heat, or other chemical compounds, which we'll talk about a little later, may cause some icky smells and stuff in your fermentation if, you know, other things kind of get in there.
Gotcha.
And that's the kind of fermentation that happens when we're referring to alcohol. And fermentation in a broader sense, it's not to be confused with like when you're making pickles, which is a specific kind called lactofermentation, or in vinegars, which is oxidative fermentation, or even in wine itself, there's chemical processes called malolactic fermentation. Now, none of those are sugar turning into alcohol, but they are chemicals being broken down by a microorganism to create a new substance.
Gotcha.
So that is fermentation.
Yeah. So y'all stick with us. Obviously, you can tell just from the first couple of minutes, this is going to be kind of a dense episode.
Yeah, pretty science heavy. But honestly, these are the kind of podcasts that I loved listening to. So I was really jazzed researching this one.
Okay, me too, because this has been sort of where I stumble when it comes to learning about beer. Because, hello, I have a liberal arts degree. Yeah. So I haven't really taken any science classes since high school. And so this is all being self-taught science. So, Laura, as we go through this, as I walk through the steps of brewing, please don't hesitate to ask me questions and clarifications.
Oh, I absolutely will. You know, because I'm a huge science nerd and I do have a degree in science and I am involved in judging science fair projects for years after college. And so, yeah, I'm all about it today. So we will all be sure to ask lots of
You're
nerdy
the
questions.
Ying to my yang in this sense. Okay. All right. So as I mentioned, fermenting, as you just described it, that is part of the larger brewing process. But the first essential step to make beer is creating or brewing a liquid that is ripe for fermentation.
Okay.
Because if you just throw some water on some barley, yeast isn't, there's nothing there for the yeast to eat.
Yeah, you just get like some mush.
Right. So how do you do that? Obviously, you have to start with a mash bill. And what a mash bill is, it's a collection or roster of grains, that those that, as I mentioned, will be soaked or steeped to make a sugary liquid called wort.
So it would be like a list of ingredients in a recipe, maybe.
Correct.
Like a mash bill would. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the most substantial amount of this mash bill is usually malted barley. This is the best material for making beer. Mm. But there can be other grains and adjuncts too, such as wheat, rye, oats, and even corn sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I remember you using the word adjunct before. That's interesting.
So, and what you're, when you're building your mash bill, it's really dependent on what kind of style you're making. So what color do you want? How strong do you want the beer to be? Which flavors do you want to come out primarily? You know, like, is it bitter? Is it sweet?
Yep.
All of those things are going to determine what your baseline mash bill is.
Gotcha.
And then once you have those, most of them are already going to be malted. There's a whole process behind malting.
You're right.
That makes the actual grains able to break down in this way. And so what you do is you take the grains and you, the first step of brewing is making oatmeal. So you put them in with water and you heat them up. And this is, the technical term is called mashing.
Okay.
But whether you're using a pot on your kitchen stove or a massive 15 barrel system, this process is going to be the same.
Okay. And that's neat. Okay.
Yeah. Basically what you do is you just put your grains at a specific temperature, and that temperature, you boil them. Well, you don't boil them, but you raise them to a certain temperature to where the starch in the grains converts into fermentable sugars.
And so is that temperature different depending on what your grain is or what your mash bill is?
Most of this happens between 110 and 166 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
But the temperature is super duper important because it determines how fermentable your beer will be, which also determines whether or not it's dry or sweet.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I see. What I learned about starches, which I think is pretty cool and super nerdy.
Yeah. Please lay it on me.
So starches are technically polymers of sugar, which means that they are a network of large molecules that when they reach a certain temperature, they're broken down by enzymes into smaller molecular components.
Mm.
And that includes maltose, which is the simple sugar in yeast, or the simple sugar that yeast can eat and ferment.
Maltose.
So that's why you have to heat them up, so you can break those bonds and unleash the maltose and make it available for yeast to eat.
Yeah.
So if you don't do that, you can't make beer.
Damn it.
Is it maltose or maltose?
Maltose. Excuse me.
And the only reason I say it, because I'm so used to saying fructose, sucrose. Like, you know, the
maltose.
Yeah.
Yes.
The toast. Ooh, the nerd just showed. I was like, that's not the proper suffix for that, I don't think.
Thank you.
Yeah, maltose. Sorry to nitpick.
No worries.
Okay, so starches. Got it. It's pretty similar to a lot of like nutrition things I've learned about starches as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, molecular compound. Cool.
So far in brewing, we've picked our grains, we've put them in water, we've heated them up and made them ready for yeast. Now what we have to do is sparge. And that means...
I love that word.
I know. I did that.
Sparge.
Yeah, sparge. Yeah, it sounds like something I need to be doing regularly.
Sparge them. Yeah. And basically what that means is just running a whole bunch of hot water over your grains so that you can extract the max amount of sugars available.
Okay. So if you pour a bunch of water over your grain, do you keep all the water that's coming off of it? Like,
yes.
Is it going to make things too watery? What if you get too much water? Is that a thing?
No.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you use a certain amount of water.
Gotcha.
Depending on how much beer you're
to
making.
To maximize that.
Yeah, because basically if you don't add water, it's this super thick,
sludge,
almost kind of syrupy consistency.
Okay.
So adding water boils it down, and it also like gets all the extra sugars that might be sitting on the grains.
Like what amount of water? What are we talking about?
I don't know specifics. It really depends on
how much mash.
If you're making, let's see, I'm having trouble remembering how much water we used, but for a couple gallons of beer, you're going to need a couple gallons of water.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Ish.
Ish, yeah, loosely.
Yeah.
All right. Sparging.
So after you sparge, you rinse your grains, then you take the grains out.
Oh,
and
so
now,
you're done with those. Yeah, you get those out of there.
Get those out of here. That's essentially trash. And the delicious liquid that you are left with is called wort, which is,
that is a delicious sounding name for it.
It is an elegant word.
Yeah, wort.
An elegant word.
I wonder what the etymology of that word is, like where it comes from.
Should have looked that
German,
up.
German, maybe?
Wort. Yeah, wort. Well, actually, I think you're supposed to say it wort.
Wort. Oh. Wort. Am I really just putting the stank on it?
I think wort. I was too.
Wort.
Well, because that's how it's spelled, W-O-R-T. And that liquid is just full of sugars dying to be fermented. Oh, so
it's a party in there. They're just waiting for it to start.
Yes.
Waiting for the DJ.
So, but you're not done yet.
Mm.
After you have your wort, you need to boil the wort.
Oh, okay.
And the importance of this is that it stops enzyme activity.
Oh, yep. That's important in science.
And it sterilizes the wort. So it gets all the bacteria out of there.
Oh, okay. Like all those weird little extra like bacteria or yeasty things in there that might make those weird flavors that we don't
exactly
want in there. Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, it's coming back full circle.
And then once you are in the part of the boil, that's when you make your hop additions and build out the bitterness in your profile. And it's a scientific term called isomerization. Basically what's happening in the hop.
Nailed it.
Yep, nailed it.
Isomerization. So basically what's happening with the hops is a process called isomerization of its alpha acids in there. And that's what brings out the bitterness of the hops.
It
makes those alpha acids wort soluble. So it actually like blends into the brew.
Oh, so we like that. If you like an IPA, you like isomerization.
Isomerization.
Yeah.
Yes. So
that's when you add your hops. Okay,
yes.
Got it.
So that is a big, long-winded answer for what brewing is, but it is really a process unique to beer. And there are actually several different ways that you can mash your grains, too. You can do single infusion, which means you just make oatmeal once, and you rinse the grains and you take them out.
Okay, Simple, easy enough.
Yeah, there's a German method called decoction, which is basically where you have the wort, you take a portion of it and heat it up, and then add it back. Take a portion, heat it up,
I've
add it back.
That.
So it's more of like a gradual heating process.
I've heard of that, like tempering it. Kind of.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then my friend, actually, that I brewed Cat in the Attic with, he just did this thing that he calls a night mash, where he basically mashed the grains and let them sit overnight. And then when he woke up in the morning, he brought the whole thing up to temp and then sparged and finished the whole brewing process.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's kind of seems like a no mess, no fuss approach.
I know, but I was like, you don't need to spend a whole day brewing. You can like go to sleep and like
do something else.
Right?
Wow.
Now, there is a way that homebrewers especially can sidestep a lot of this whole.
Yeah, it's a pretty intensive process.
Yeah. So one thing that you can do is use extract, which is essentially a concentrated wort. Normally comes as a powder or a syrup. I actually don't have much experience with this because the first homebrew kit that my friend ever bought me was all grain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was like,
ambitious.
Making oatmeal on my kitchen counter to make 1 gallon of beer.
Wow.
But I know a lot of people do that.
Yeah, I actually do have some experience with extract because when I stopped consuming glutens almost 9 years ago, one of the hardest things to let go of was beer. And just at the time, there just really was not, 10 years ago, there just wasn't, at least available in Texas, good gluten-free beer.
Yeah. I would still argue that maybe that whole scene has yet to ripen.
Yeah, coming out there. Actually, again, not to keep talking about Australia, but they had some really great ones available from Europe that I haven't seen here before.
Ooh. We'll have to talk about that later this season.
So about 8 years ago, Flew and I started dabbling in home brewing so we could start making gluten-free beer. And really the only thing available in the stores at that time was gluten-free beer extract. And it was really like just, you know, like a big, like, you know, that you'd get that workout protein powder in, like a big tub like that.
Yeah.
You screw it off and it's like molasses coming out of there. And like really you just didn't have a lot of choices. Like the only thing I could really get was like sorghum, which if you've had sorghum beer, like, I'm just going to go on record just saying sorghum's fucking gross.
I have had a sorghum beer and I was like, I would rather not drink beer than drink this shit.
Enter wine into my life.
Enter where we are today.
Yeah. So I actually have a question for you about the spent grains, the leftover grains.
Mm-hmm.
So you just toss those. Can you do anything with them? Can you like re-brew them?
Oh, this is actually a great question. You can't re-brew them because you've taken all of the necessary, like, characteristics drinks out of it.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
But what you can do is instead of throw them away, homebrewers and really anyone, I guess, can make, like, cookies out of them.
Oh, yeah. No, you mentioned I've gotten dog biscuits.
Yeah, you can make dog treats. A lot of the commercial brewers in DFW actually partner with farms to trade their spent grain to the farmers as, like...
Lovely.
Yeah, to feed their livestock. And so it's kind of like, hey, free trash removal / free stuff to feed your livestock. Let's see. Anything else you can do?
I mean,
my friend has made pie crusts and pizza dough from spent grains.
Wow, pie crusts. That would be interesting. Yeah. If I get the right pie, that'd be delicious.
For sure. And you can compost them. And then I know there's a new brew pub out in Mansfield that's planning to, there's a taco shop in it. Mm. They're planning to use some of their spent grains to make tortillas.
Oh, wow.
So any starchy product.
Cool. Well, there's some similarities for sure with wine. The first one that pops out to me is your wart.
Your wart. Thanks for telling everyone about my warts.
That one is just really, so, okay. I guess let me backtrack a little bit. The same kind of effort is made in wine to reuse the kind of same crushed skins and seeds and stuff of like that spent grain. There's a little bit of like controversy. So some people, some like home winemakers or wineries might take that crushed stems and seeds and...
So everything besides the liquid after the grapes are crushed, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that leftover stuff, the spent grain of wine, if you will. And they might like rehydrate that and try to get another like run of it.
Oh, really?
To make like a second batch of wine, which obviously sounds really gross, and it is. That wine that you get off of that is not good.
Oh my God, yeah. Why?
So a lot of people, instead of even bothering with that, will just return it back to the vineyard or to local farms as fertilizer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Like compost. So...
Yeah. What is all of that stuff called? So, like, to make wine, you basically crush grapes and you get the juice out.
Yeah. Okay. So, so you know when you have all of your grains and water together and it's all mushed together and it's called wort. So, the equivalent of that in wine is
wort is just the liquid post-spent grain.
Okay. I'm glad you're clarifying. So, it gets kind of nitty-gritty like that with the wine as well. So, when you crush it... And the juice is still with the skins and the stems and the seeds. It's called must.
Ooh.
And in red wine, you let the must sit for a little while to get the color, you know. And then when you drain the juice off, all the junk left over is called pomace.
Interesting.
So the pomace is kind of what you can use as fertilizer or definitely maybe not make a second press wine out of.
Yeah, that sounds really gross. Because, like, has it not, like, the spent grain, has that not lost all of its nutritional?
It's like quality. Like you said, it's just the qualities that make, like, the tannins and the, you know, the color. And it's watered down at that point.
Okay.
It's like, yeah. Yeah, so that was really interesting. I thought that parallel. But as far as the mash bill, like going back to the, like the beginning of your process, there's not like really a lot that's the same in wine.
Even if it's like a blend, you don't like have to crush the grapes together or anything?
Yeah, so this is how it breaks down. You winemakers definitely have choices and some control about the profile of their wine in the sense of like a mash bill, air quote. For instance, they can make decisions like, are we using only fruit we produced ourselves or are we buying fruit from nearby farms? Mm-hmm. That's some control over like what makes up your ingredients.
Okay.
You can also ask if we're using only our fruit, will this be wine be from a specific lot or a specific vineyard or even down to a specific row and be like a higher end kind of wine from their like elite parts of their
interesting.
Yeah. Because if like the sun hits it right and the wind hits it right and the water hits it right, then they can charge more for that wine. They don't want to blend that in with like the rest of their
stuff.
You know?
Your A-team.
And then they could also ask questions like, are we using only fruit from our state or are we outsourcing to ship in more from other states? And that's typically like mass-produced wineries.
Okay.
That they just need content. You know, they just need the juice. And when it comes down to the blending choices, like you mentioned, of like, oh, this Chianti's too harsh. Do I need some Merlot to mellow it out? Is this Chardonnay too acidic? Should I bring it out, chill it out with some Pinot Meunier? Those blending choices are typically occurring after fermentation when they're tasting and blending.
Gotcha. So it's already like the produced liquid and then you blend it. You're not like blending grapes to make a unique must.
Right. And I guess like, and with all the caveat to all this is there are people just like bending the rules everywhere. So
take this for what you will. Grain of salt.
Yeah, so
I must warn you that.
Yeah, I must warn you.
I must warn you that not all of these apply to everyone.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I love it. Okay. So not the same with mash bill, but some element of control over what fruit goes in.
Sure.
So maybe a grape bill That doesn't seem like quite as recipe driven as beer, though.
Yeah.
And so I mentioned earlier that when the grape juice is left on the skins and stems, a few things happen. It starts, the skins start to impart color mm-hmm. and tannins and flavor into the juice that they're soaking in. Mm-hmm. And when you soak them, when winemakers choose to soak the skins with the wine before fermentation, you can do that for as short as a couple of hours for rosé to get that nice light pink color. Or you can do that for a couple of days in cases of like Syrah and Cab, and you won't really want that like bold tannic, you know, elements of the wine.
Okay, so this reminds me, the first time that I found out this fact I'm about to say, my mind was blown that white wines aren't always made from white grapes, and red wines aren't, like, always just made from red grapes.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go next.
What?
So, yeah, okay, so for example, with champagne. Champagne is typically made from three different kinds of grapes. Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier, and Pinot Noir. So of those three grapes, two of them are red or black grapes. But champagne is not a red wine.
No, it comes even close.
Beautifully crystal clear. And that's because when the grapes are pressed, the juice is removed from the skin immediately, so no characteristics from the skins are imparted into the wine.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you can get other white wines this way. Like some other examples people are playing with are like a Sangiovese Bianco from Tuscany or like a Cabernet Sauvignon Blanco from Mexico, which Mexico has a pretty decent budding wine scene, which I don't think people give them enough credit for.
Mexico is not even on the top 10 places I first think to get a
like
wine.
Temecula are coming up. I mean, it's pretty fucking close to Mexico, you know?
We should do an episode on Mexico.
We should.
And go to Mexico.
And the cool thing about them not having a lot of pressure about reputation there is they have the freedom to experiment with some of these things like white Cab Sauv.
So, white Cab Sauv.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's so really interesting. Well, because Cab Sauv, in my mind, that is like a color.
Right. Right. Yeah. And like the tasting notes on it are really interesting. Like, it's the flavors that go with tannins, but, like, the tannins aren't there to, like, so it's kind of like a mind flip, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh. So
this beer is getting really good as it warms up. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I bet that style is a nice little bit warmer. Another important thing to note here is with wine, because there's so much sugar in the fruit, sometimes fermentation can start a little early before it gets to, like, the fermentation tanks.
Gotcha.
So, for instance, if it's an exceedingly hot day while the grapes are being picked or the fruit is mishandled and squished as it's being, like, driven on the tractor in to go through the grape crusher, you know, some weird things can start happening in the heat and the squish where fermentation will start to happen in the sun before it, like, gets into the winery. And then you get all kinds of weird flavors and the fruit kind of gets ruined.
Because those are kind of, like, unexpected yeasts that are coming in and nom-nom-nomming.
Yeah. So for mass-produced wineries where they really control any natural yeast being there and eradicate them, that's important. But also for, like, small wineries like Burgundy, you don't want to, like, mishandle and, like, have funky flavors in your fruit when you have such a finite amount of it.
For sure.
So, and when it does get really hot in certain places, like in Texas Hill Country or Australia's Hunter Valley, you might even see some wineries harvesting fruit, like, at nighttime in, like, the cool of the night to preserve the characteristics. Like, they're, you know, it's just a better time to pick them for flavors.
Oh, my gosh, that's so smart, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed that actually when we were traveling through Italy, a lot of the produce that we drove through was, like, harvested at night.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, especially because, like, first of all, like, people, and then, yeah, you have to store those grapes probably in not that controlled of circumstances and environments.
Right.
So I guess the yeast in this situation is kind of the big thing.
Mm-hmm. Before we get started, I wanted to say all that to say, that's all the pre-steps into getting the juice that you will then introduce yeast into to ferment. So that was all the backstory of how we get to fermentation for wine.
Awesome.
So take it away with yeast.
Yeah, okay. That was a lot to digest.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
No, on my part too. So maybe let's take a break. You guys refill your glasses.
Quick break. That sounds like a great idea.
And we'll be right back. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love making this show, and we hope you enjoy listening to it, too.
That's right, and we want to give a huge shout-out to our very first Patreon donor, Jeremy.
Whoop, whoop! Jeremy was so kind to pledge at the happy hour date level, which means he gets a shout out on air, as well as an invitation to our postseason happy hour.
If you want a shout out on air, you can pledge as a drinking buddy, and to be invited to our end of season happy hour, donate at the happy hour date level. And to really knock our socks off, our top tier is Pick Your Poison, where donors can pick a topic for an upcoming episode.
Go to patreon.com/grapesandgrain to pledge your monthly contribution today.
Cheers, y'all. All right. Well, welcome back, guys. That was a much deserved...
Hell of a break.
Much deserved break after that heavy info sesh.
Yeah, lots of information to digest, lots of beer to digest.
And we'll have lots of links and sources on our blog post, corresponding blog post with this episode.
Yeah.
But so to jump back into it, we left off with... We finally got to fermentation. We left off with yeast.
Yes. So we did. Yeast. So yeast. This... plays a part in fermentation, and for beer, at least, it absolutely can define the flavor of a beer. Yeah. So,
oh, good. I'm glad you have the definition of yeast here.
Yes.
It's kind of an elusive term you hear a lot, but, like, do you actually know what it is?
Yeah, it's like an invisible thing that eats sugar. But the technical definition is it's a single-celled organism in the fungi class of flora. And flora is just a fancy word for plants of a particular region, habitat, or like a geological period.
Right,
so
a classification.
Right. So it's a single-celled organism. And when we talk about brewing, there are two main species that we're talking about. The first one is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and that is what's also known as an ale yeast. And then there's Saccharomyces uvarum, and that's what's known as a lager yeast.
Nailed it. Is that Latin? Like, Latin nailed it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Probably. Yeah.
I just consider it
naming
like science.
Conventions with, are typically Latin, right? Or maybe Greek. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Cool.
So in beer.
Saccharomyces.
Saccharomyces. Oh, tantalizing.
Yeah.
So in beer, lots of yeast strains are used for different types of beer. Mm. I'm reading this book right now. It's called The Brewmaster's Table. Mm. And in it, it compares yeast to, like, dogs.
Yeah. Oh, I love this comparison.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, all of dogs are the exact same species, right? They're all dogs. But you wouldn't want a chihuahua to guard your house any more than you would want a German lager yeast to ferment an English bitter ale.
Gotcha.
So, well, the yeast you choose,
for the works,
yes, it's
done.
Like certain yeasts thrive and create better flavors when they're matched with certain, you know, types of wort.
Totally.
Yes.
I think that illustration is really what made it click for me.
Yeah. And, you know, yeast is super important today, but 500 years ago when Reinheitsgebot was written, and if you guys remember, that is the German purity law. When that was written, it only originally included three ingredients. So it was, you know, water, hops, and malt, because they didn't know that yeast was actually coming in and spontaneously fermenting their beer because they couldn't see it. So centuries later is when they discovered that. But yeah, so when I mentioned that book earlier, The Brewmaster's Table, I read something that said it doesn't matter which strain of wine yeast, a vintner uses to make wine. Is that true?
Okay, yeah, you brought that up the other day, and my knee-jerk reaction was like, what the fuck? of course it matters.
Fucking beer elitist.
Yeah, it was
beer snob.
Are you just trying to like, yeah. And then I got really caught up in the motive. Like, what is his motivations for making that statement? Is he trying to like discredit wine or, yeah. But the long and the short of it is like, yeah, it definitely matters. Of course it does. Just like in beer, it matters in wine. In wine, also, we use that same Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It's the main strain of yeast used in winemaking, and also as like a baker's yeast in bread, for that matter, as well. Mm. But there are extensive wine yeast catalogs out there. And just like you compared German lager strain fermenting an English bitter ale, the same idea holds true for wine. Like, would you want to use a champagne yeast to ferment a big, bold Cabernet? And the answer is probably not.
Probably not. Yeah. No, because cabs don't have, like, all the bubbles.
Right. And it's just like, yeah, there's so many characteristics that suit certain styles better. And there's a gentleman who puts it a little better than me. His name is Shay A.J. Comfort. And he's a gentleman who's helped start More Wine!
He sounds so comfortable.
And works for Hallalmond. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. But both of those are, like, places you can get, like, the wine yeast catalogs, like I was mentioning.
Oh, so they're like a yeast
vendor?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's great. So
there's one in beer, a big player. They're called White Labs. And so that's where a lot of people source their yeast. So they're basically like yeast farmers.
Yeah, they're just cultivating.
Yes. Cultivators.
Yeah, cultivators.
Farmers, whatever. Yeah. Agricultural vintners.
So this guy, Shay A.J. Comfort, he has done extensive fermentation research on yeast, oak and malolactic bacteria, tannins, oxygen for this company he's working for. And he's created yeast and malolactic bacteria trials and along with giving technical winemaking presentations throughout the country. So he kind of knows what he's talking about. And he says, quote, next to the actual fruit in wine, yeast strain selection is the most important element that will determine the quality and style of the wine. Mm. Each strain has its strengths and weaknesses in their ability to structure, express fruit qualities, and ferment, end quote.
Yeah, and I feel like that sums up yeast in a nutshell.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so that's why I was like, what do you mean?
You can just throw any yeast in any grapes and it'll turn out fine.
And I mean, I guess if we learned anything from your boss who made Instapot Welch's grape juice wine... Technically.
Sure.
So anyways, depending on your choice or strain, depending on your choice of strain and fermentation events, yeast can be used to enhance or accentuate varietal characteristics like the big, complex, oaky flavors in a red. Mm-hmm. Or you can use it to just basically do the work of fermentation and then hop out of the way so it doesn't get in the way of flavors and like a lighter, crisper, easier drinking summer white.
Yes. Okay. I'm interested in this too because most wine is aged in barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's got to be some natural yeast in there too. So how does that compare to like when they're controlled, adding yeast in a controlled environment?
Right. Put a pin
in that.
I can answer that. Yeah. Let's put a pin in that because I will get to that in just a second because that is an extremely valid question.
Okay.
The last thing I want to say about yeast imparting flavors is that you cannot save a bad wine through yeast. Like, it cannot impart so many good flavors into your wine. You can't, like, save it.
Because part of their job is also to accentuate whatever flavors are kind of already in there.
Right. So, then moving on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if there's funky, gross flavors in there, they're going to, like, underline
boss,
and outline them. Yeah. Like,
boss
exclamation
wine.
Point.
It tastes like boss wine.
Yeah, exactly. So, to answer your question, the natural yeasts or commercially available yeasts in wine. So you can buy yeast from commercial vendors, like we mentioned, either in small formats for your home winemakers or who have tons of options, by the way, or as a commercial winemaker who actually have more options with unique strains to choose from.
Yeah. Is it the same as like when you buy yeast at the homebrew store, you got to like slap it to wake it up before you put it in there?
Pretty much actually any yeast that you use in baking or anything, you have to like activate it. So
Ooh, that's cool. It's always my favorite part. I'm like,
yeah. So the yeast will either come as a dry powder or a liquid. And if, you know, if it's a dry powder, you have to hydrate it, you know, give it a little shake and jiggle, activate it before you inoculate your batch of booze with it.
Me too.
Yeah. when you add yeast to your wine that you've bought from a store, it is called a cultured yeast. Like mm-hmm. we mentioned earlier, these cultivators of yeasts, these purveyors. Of cultivated yeasts. But there's another type of yeast used in fermentation of wine that is either native, natural, or wild yeasts.
Mm, yes.
Yeah. So exciting. We love these.
Yes.
Native yeast is yeast that is naturally occurring in the area. It's just swirling through the air and the wind and clinging to the vegetation, and it can be found on the grape skins when you harvest them.
Okay.
So the process of not adding the commercially cultivated yeast and letting your grape juice ferment on its own with native yeast in the area is called natural or spontaneous fermentation. And you can leave vats wide open while they ferment like this on the top during this process.
Yeah, absolutely. The spontaneous fermentation is a big thing in beer, too.
Mm.
A lot of wines get their terroir from where the grapes are grown.
Mm.
But in beer, terroir can refer to where the yeast comes from.
Oh,
because,
I love that.
As we've mentioned previously, a lot of the ingredients in beer do not grow where a lot of the beer makers are.
Yeah.
But if you leave your wort, as we talked about earlier, exposed to the natural elements, mm-hmm. instead of slapping the bag of yeast and pouring it into the vat, you just leave it open, like our friends down at Jester King in Dripping Springs.
I was going to say, you brought some Jester King last season, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they just brew a beer, they leap it upstairs in the barn that they've refurbished with the doors open, and they just let the wind come in and spontaneously ferment it.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
It is really cool. And, you know, so spontaneous fermentation or natural fermentation can be a big gamble. gamble as well, but with great risk comes great reward. Mm-hmm. So, well, let me spoil a batch here and there. It also gives you some extremely unique
booze.
Yeah.
A lot of the times the word used in the beer community is funky to describe that kind of wild.
Yes.
So wild.
It is so wild.
So does that mean that the grapes that naturally have the yeast on them, mm-hmm. does that get mixed in with the yeast, or are those washed and cleansed?
So if you are a large, that's a great question. If you are a large scale mass produced winery, you definitely don't want these natural yeast in there funking up your cookie cutter formula.
So you're washing
them. You sterilize, like you said, you sterilize the wort. You either wash them or sterilize in some way. So none of those naturally occurring yeast are funking up your jug of wine.
But if you're looking for doing something maybe small batch or more experimental, then maybe it's not as important to have consistency. That's one of the big arguments in the beer community is like, is consistency really a good thing? Or like, should every batch be like art where none of it is the same?
Yes.
So people who usually, preach the wild fermentation, spontaneous fermentation gospel are more of in the art camp where they're like, we want to produce whatever the yeast, comes about. And they are different techniques for that, including things like what's called a fooder, which is a giant wooden vat that has natural yeast cultivating in it.
Right.
And so that's why I asked about the barrels, because also when you barrel age a beer, it gets some of those natural yeast that change the entire profile of the beer itself.
So that's exactly what's going to be my next point is you are, not all wines, but a lot of wines, you are barrel aging. So if, for instance, in these mass-produced wineries, some of this funky yeast gets on their juice that makes it into their barrel, they can't really keep using that barrel because the barrels are so porous. Any funky bacteria that gets in them, that's just, that kind of lives there forever now. So you just got to cut your losses with that one, get a new barrel, which is a shame because they're pricey, but better to make the investment.
Absolutely.
And that's why in brewing and in winemaking, it is really an exercise of cleanliness.
Absolutely. Sanitation is the number one most important thing.
Which is the most I think arduous part about starting as a home brewer or home winemaker, because 90% of it is just cleaning.
Yes. 90% of it. You always got to have a big tub full of sanitizer. You got to dip your hands in there before you do anything.
And you always forget at one step. You're like, fuck, I dropped it in the whole batch and I didn't sanitize it. And I think it is also worth pointing out with this that for the last 8,000 years, humans have been using natural yeast and fermentation in their fermentation of all things.
Yeah.
And that only within the last century or so has commercial yeast cultivation become an industry.
Oh.
So,
fascinating.
So there's that.
I did not know that.
Where does yeast come from?
Everywhere.
It's just out there.
It's out there, baby.
Like atoms.
It's on your skin right now.
Yeah. The yeast are here with us recording this podcast. It's
microorganisms are up. Mm. Yeah. If you are freaked out by little things, you should not learn about microorganisms. I will guarantee you.
Don't go down the yeast road.
So to build on fermentation, there is, so we talked about fermentation. And there is also a process called secondary fermentation.
Dun, dun, dun. It's like fermentation, but
again,
second.
It was so nice. We'll do it twice. In wine and beer, there's this process called secondary fermentation. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here with the beer side of this, because my research might be a little loose on the beer half of this. So there's secondary fermentation and there's also bottle conditioning, and they're not exactly the same things.
Okay.
So in the first stage of fermentation in the container that the liquid is fermenting in, both beer and wine, there's typically a hole on the top of the container called a bunghole. I'm sorry.
Come on.
I can't.
I know that's a word. It's a bung.
Bunghole, and that's then stuffed with a cork.
Yeah, but that, a bung.
Yes, but it's during
cork.
The fermentation process, it's not a cork, it is an airlock. An airlock is this really nifty little device that it's like a tube filled with water so that the gases that we talked about that are released during fermentation can escape the container out through the water, bubble out through the water, but air from the outside world with weird yeasties can't get back in through the airlock.
What I love most is on a commercial scale when breweries, they have a blow-off tube, which is essentially the same thing because they have, their giant commercial setups.
Yeah.
And the blow-off tube sometimes will just overflow and yeast foam will go everywhere. Yeah. I know it's probably not their favorite moment, but I will watch Instagram videos of that for days.
It is.
4 days.
Oh, it's probably really annoying to clean up, but that's so funny.
So that's primary fermentation.
So, yes,
though.
That is primary fermentation. So before you throw it into a bottle, all that to say, once you have that primary fermentation with a beer, you can slap that puppy in a keg, hook it up to a CO2 line, and it is carbonated and ready to go for consumers. But if you want to bottle it, sometimes it might need to go into a secondary fermentation to let off any existing yeasties, finish up their process before being put into the bottle with the primer, because you don't. I don't know. This is where it gets a little dicey for me, because
bottle conditioning, at least from a homebrew standpoint, and some commercial breweries do this, but it's very labor intensive.
Yes.
So a lot of don't. A lot of Belgian breweries still do this because
it's
all
very
like
indicative
hand-bottled.
Of their style too.
Yes.
The way that that's what I was going to say is the flavors you get from bottle conditioning, if you haven't done the secondary fermentation, can be very flavorful. So in like what you just said, the German wit,
Belgian,
you want those weird extra flavors during that.
But the whole reason that a lot of people do it is because what you do is add sugar. So you reawaken the yeast to begin producing flavors, but also produce CO2.
Yes.
So if you're connecting it in a keg to CO2, you don't need bubbles.
Right.
But if you're just putting it in a bottle, you want CO2 because you want it to be fizzy, which is the problem that my friend Justin and I had with this cat in the attic, is that we added the sugar, but the yeast didn't seem to take or something.
Yeah, it didn't.
So it's primarily to add carbonation and also a little bit of extra flavor.
Yeah. Okay. So there is bottle conditioning within wine as well.
Is it different?
It is pretty darn similar. So it mostly happens with champagne, I will say, because
that's super bubbly.
Yeah. So in champagne, you do the same thing. You put sugar in the bottle. And in champagne, that is called the dosage. And how much sugar...
Hold on.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Dosage.
Nailed it. That is so sexy.
So how much sugar you put in depends on, like, how sweet your champagne is, like, in the end.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So I like drier stuff, so they put a little bit of less sugar in there. But it's the same thing. So they take their primary fermented wine, and then they put it into the bottle for their secondary fermentation or bottle conditioning with the sugar. And then in wine specifically, it is required to be on that yeast for 12 months minimum.
No wonder that shit is so expensive.
Yeah. And there's this whole process with, like, riddling racks, and we can go into that another day. But the important thing to note here is that the yeast eats the sugar and then it dies and it's just like still in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And all that extra CO2 is being created, and so much CO2 and carbonation is being created in a bottle of champagne that it like dissolves back into itself. Like it.
Okay.
And then when
it vaporizes?
Yeah. It like, I'm forgetting the word of it. It like turns back into a chemical, and when you pop it open, then it turns back into bubbles.
Oh,
you know
okay.
It doesn't like store as bubbles. It's dissolved gas or something like that within the wine. Okay. Anyways, but once the yeast dies, it sits on what's called lees. Lees are all the dead yeast, and that's what gives champagne its characteristic biscuity flavor, is spending all that time sitting on the yeast.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. In beer, there's very rarely disengorgement.
Which is how you get all the lees and dead yeast out of the champagne bottles,
right? So there's very little of that was also mentioned in my book. I was like, I know word.
So you just like leave the sediment in beer if there happens to be beer. Interesting.
Yep. Definitely.
Yeah, and I guess that happens in some wines as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So sorry, we got a little roundabout there, but we made
hot
it back
and heavy. Well, while we're on the subject of lees we're on the subject of yeast, I wanted to bring you an update to something that we mentioned in our first season.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember talking about why lager yeast is so special?
Yes.
Like, it was discovered in a cave, and scientists were tracing its roots. It's a hybrid yeast, and scientists were tracing its roots, and lager became a thing up in Bavaria, but they discovered the other hybrid yeast strain that melded with it to create lager yeast in Patagonia, right?
Yeah, so wild.
How did they get on the other sides of the world? Well, literally the other day, I got an email from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is home to the researcher that discovered that whole thing.
Oh, wow.
There is an update.
Oh,
so,
wow, late on us.
Yeah, so to get specific, the lager yeast, the hybrids are Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces ubeanus.
Yeah.
Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces ubeanus.
Yeah.
Okay. So in 2011,
That's when they discovered that the Ubanus was came from Patagonia.
Oh, okay.
So recently, though, they discovered how the lager yeast is able to survive at colder temperatures. And it turns out that the lager yeast is able to do this because it shares a mutation that comes from the mitochondria of the Ubanus thing. So the mitochondria is
the powerhouse of the cell.
Yes, the powerhouse of the cell. And because it has that other strain's powerhouse, it's able to survive at lower temperatures.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Neato.
And then other research
and about by powerhouse of the cell, we mean that's a like little bit inside of a cell that makes the energy, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I just am repeating that from like a movie quote.
Yeah.
I think.
Thank you for that. So the other research that they just published is about how lager yeast is able to do what's called fermenting all the way out, which means this yeast will eat every sugar available in the wort, which not all yeast can do
like
that.
Hit a carrying capacity. It will just keep nomming until
correct.
Ain't nothing.
And so the strain essentially is also mutated and created. It has mutated and it creates a new protein that is able to process the specific compound known as maltotriose.
Okay.
And that's crazy shit because it can only do that because of the Ubanus.
Oh, wow.
Strain.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
And so all of this led them to the researchers that published this research. They're now hybridizing other parts of these two strains to see what else they could do.
The possibilities are out there.
And
yeah.
they think it might revolutionize brewing. This is a quote from the report that I read.
Yeah.
It'll make pure Saccharomyces ubanus beers less cloying and drier, more conventional like a lager, but it will still retain some of the wild character that you can expect from the wild cold tolerant strain.
Wow.
So they expect that maybe brewers will start using this hybrid that they've made because it doesn't take as long as lager yeast traditionally does.
Yeah.
It's able to ferment at warmer temperatures.
Wow, but not with any of the funky flavors.
Correct. Wow. So this is like brand new research.
That's
brand
really news. Crazy. Can you imagine if like the natural fermenters were already in their camp? This is even more
right,
like not contrived, but constructed scientifically. Maybe
that's, I know. I just thought that was really so crazy. Cool. That was like an update.
Yeah, that's really timely and relevant for them to email you personally.
Yeah,
tell them
I think
you.
The bottom line is like yeast is crazy shit. I did. I wrote him back and I was
interesting.
Like, oh my
very
god,
interesting.
I'm aware of Chris Hettinger's work and I'm so impressed and blah blah blah. And they're like, cool.
Like
so you're gonna write about this? I was like. Well, I'm not technically qualified to write about it right now. I feel like our science reporter might do better, but I'm going to mention it in my podcast.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to tell you guys good job. Thanks for the PR update.
Well done. Love beer. Great job. What you're doing is important.
Yeah. I'm going to send you I'll send you something.
Well, how often do you get yeast news?
Yeast news. Gross. Yeah. Hopefully not that often.
Yeah, me.
Oh, God. Okay. That was a lot of information. We did a good job. High five.
High five. Let's bring it back with something a little lighter and more relatable for normal
people. A little more digestible. We'll be here all day. Many other things can be fermented aside from
wine. And beer.
Some examples are mead.
Mm-hmm.
Mead has a really similar fermentation process to wine. The main difference is that the fermentable sugar in mead is honey instead of grape juice. And it's the same action of yeast converting sugars into alcohol.
That is so true.
Right.
I just wrote about mead and
everybody
was like, but what is it? Is it wine? It's called honey wine. And I was like, well, but it's not wine.
It's mead. The thing. Yeah. It's its own kind of thing.
Similarly fermented to wine.
Yes.
Where does mead come from?
The Any medieval honey. Times.
Well, I know Renaissance-y, but I mean, grapes.
The Scarborough Fair.
Is it grapes? What is it?
It's honey.
Honey and water.
Honey and water.
Oh, it's, for real?
Yeah, honey is a fermentable sugar. Yeah, there's no, it's
honey and water and yeast.
Ferments. Yeah. So that's what makes it interesting, huh?
Yeah.
It's really expensive to ferment. Like, I made a mead once, and it was pricey because it was a lot of honey to buy, and, like, raw honey is really flipping expensive. And then I didn't have the proper, like, cap on it, so I waited, and you have to wait a long time for it to ferment, like 6 or 12 months.
Oh, gosh.
Waited for
what?
A year.
Really?
Well, the one that I did, the recipe I had it was. And then I went to go get it, and I had the wrong kind of cap, and the pressure from the fermentation unscrewed it, and the whole thing was flat. And it was the most disappointing, expensive year of my life.
Oh, my God. I was going to make you a...
What a long year.
I was going to make you a mead for Christmas.
I just waited for that mead. Oh, that would have been lovely.
I was going to call it Integra Mead.
Oh. Integrity. So other things can be fermented as well, like pickles, sauerkraut, and kimchi.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Veggies.
They're all created using a process called lactofermentation, which is really amazing. So the starches and the sugars in the vegetables are converted into lactic acid, not lactose sugar, lactic acid.
Okay.
By bacteria called lactobacilli. Vinegar is also fermented. It's created by a process called oxidative fermentation, where sugars are converted into acetic acids. And even within the wine making its process itself, there's another kind of fermentation chemical process called malolactic fermentation. Typically, you're referring to wines like Chardonnays, where malic acid, which is the acid from like green apples, is converted into lactic acid, which is the acid in like creamy milks. So that's what gives Chardonnay its like buttery, creamy qualities.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned lactobacilli. Lactobacillus is also one of the yeasts that is used to make sour beers because produces.
Or is it yeast or is it a bacteria that's added to the yeast?
Oh, it's a bacteria.
Then that they don't use yeast for those?
More to come on that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about other things that can be brewed.
What else can be brewed? I love brewed things, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about coffee and tea. And you would think in, like, if you can brew coffee and tea, like, is it fermentable? My guess is that it's not.
I'm going to add on here because in Nashville, I had a fermented sweet tea. It was sweet tea made and then with champagne yeast added. And that was alcoholic. And also...
it was alcoholic?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and kombucha.
And also kombucha is technically...
Is it brewed?
It's fermented.
Yeah, right. So we're talking about things that are brewed that can be fermented.
Yeah, so I would argue that tea could be fermented, but you have to add the sugar.
Okay. Well, if that was your experience, I did a little bit of research online trying to figure out, like, if you brew coffee, is there a way to naturally make it alcoholic without adding Irish whiskey to it?
Yeah.
You know, and I found a coffee manufacturer on the internet that was touting their fermented coffee beans, but it explained that that's only necessary and potentially commonplace to extract the coffee bean from its actual casing.
Gotcha.
So you ferment the coffee, it breaks open, you pluck out the little coffee bean, and then you brew it.
Okay.
But another alcoholic beverage is sake.
Mm.
So sake is steeped in water, and then brewers add a fungus known as kojikin, and then they also add yeast, and then that breaks down the starches in the rice to fermentable sugars,
and that's how
you get sake. But
interesting.
I love some sake.
Yeah. My goodness. Well, I feel like I learned so much on this episode.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad we really took the effort to organize some of this information, even though it was a little dense.
It is super dense. And I'm for a lot of like homebrewers and amateur winemakers, this is going to be like 101 stuff.
It is. But like, weren't you just like searching for this information all compiled into one place when you started homebrewing and playing around with this stuff at home? Me too.
Definitely. And it makes more sense. It helps me make sense of homebrewing also, knowing the scientific processes that are behind it. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll raise a glass to that girl.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on Patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
Cheers.
What you drinking?